Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, arguing today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Defendant Sharon Sellhausen was convicted following a jury trial of battery to a police officer and disorderly conduct. She argues that she is entitled to a new trial based upon an error in jury selection. She does not contend that the jury that heard her case was not impartial. Rather, she argues that she is entitled to a new trial because she chose to use a peremptory strike to remove a prospective juror who was the presiding judge's daughter-in-law. Sellhausen contends, and the Court of Appeals agreed, that the presiding judge had a duty to sua sponte remove his daughter-in-law from the veneer panel, and that Sellhausen's subsequent use of a peremptory challenge to remove a peremptory strike, I should say, to remove the juror did not cure that error. Sellhausen bases her argument on this Court's recent decision in Toedy, and the Court of Appeals viewed its decision in this case as what it described as an interstitial application of Toedy. But the differences between this case and Toedy are substantial factually and significant legally. Both cases involve a juror who was related to the presiding judge. In Toedy, it was the judge's mother. But the similarity between the cases ends there. In Toedy, the defendant moved to strike the judge's mother for cause, but the court denied the motion. Neither party exercised a peremptory strike, and as a result, the judge's mother served on the jury that convicted Toedy. In this case, in contrast, the trial judge told the attorneys before voir dire that his daughter-in-law was on the jury panel and that he would be glad to excuse her if either party so requested. Neither party took the judge up on that offer, however, and neither party moved to challenge the juror for cause. Instead, Sellhausen used a peremptory strike to remove her. As a result, unlike Toedy, the juror who was related to the judge in this case did not serve on the defendant's jury. The Court of Appeals nevertheless reversed because it believed that under Toedy, trial judges must, as a matter of law, sua sponte remove immediate family members from the veneer pool. It did so even while acknowledging that the lead opinion in Toedy had expressly declined to address that issue. The Court of Appeals thought that its approach, a rule requiring sua sponte removal by the judge, was necessary to avoid a situation in which lawyers are hesitant to aggressively question the juror during voir dire, and judges are asked to rule on matters involving their own family members. The state agrees that it would have been preferable for the judge to sua sponte remove his daughter-in-law from the veneer panel in this case.
Counsel, do you believe that it would have been preferable or do you believe that it is the duty of the judge to sui sponte remove the daughter-in-law?
I think it is preferable, but not necessarily a duty. I think an alternative approach would be to require, obviously, that there be disclosure of the relationship. And for the court, this court could establish a rule saying upon a motion to strike an immediate family member, assuming that term is appropriately defined, that the court shall grant the motion. But unless the court were to hold that a relative of the judge is objectively biased, which the court has to date split on, I don't think there is a need for a rule requiring sua sponte.
So you disagree with paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals that says, we hold that presiding judges must sua sponte remove their immediate family members, not defined at this stage, right?
Yes.
A panel of potential jurors. That's not, the state's position is that is a erroneous holding.
Yes, but the state would not object if this court.
Okay. You object to these Court of Appeals making that decision.
I think that's not required under TOTI, and that's the type of rule that if it were to be adopted, this court is the court to do it, but it's not a necessary solution to the problem.
Isn't that an interpretation of the inherent power of the trial court, and that the inherent power of the trial court is to run an effective, efficient court, and to run an effective, efficient court, the court has to remove an immediate member from the juror so that the judge doesn't have to recuse himself, herself, and fills what was said in prior cases that if in doubt, do without. That is, if in doubt, do without the juror.
And that's why the state readily agrees it's the better practice, whether it needs to be a rule. As I said, the state does not object to it as a rule, but there's an alternative of just saying these are jurors who are subject to removal.
Counsel, what is your primary reason for saying, for expressing the opinion that it's preferable?
Because that it's preferable
for the judge, for the judge to sua sponte remove the family member, yet to be defined.
I think just as a practical matter, it avoids the lawyers having to exercise a challenge, whether I don't think the risk is great or even significant.
I guess what I'm getting at is, do you think it's more a matter of bias, or do you think it runs more towards court administration or somewhere in between?
I think it runs more to a matter of court administration and avoiding appearances of...
What appearances?
I think... that's a good question.
Thank you.
And I say that because I'm...
Counsel, what about
buying time while I...
I thought you said it because it was true.
What about a situation, for example, which is not that uncommon, where something happens with a juror, some other person sees a juror talking to somebody in the hallway, brings it to the judge's attention. The judge then has to call in the juror alone and say, okay, it's reported that you had this conversation. And there's something that goes on with that juror. You know, if you're sitting on a matter involving your own family member, that creates a whole host of issues.
Right.
Does that happen in every jury trial? No. But if that person's not sitting on the case, you're not going to be confronted with ruling on issues involving your own family member. That, for example, might be one good answer to Justice Gableman.
Are there others?
It's
always great when the bench answers the question of another.
It makes things much easier. I will assume Brendan Sullivan's role as a potted plant.
In addition, I guess more specifically put, counsel, in addition to the very erudite observation made by Justice Ziegler, would there be any additional appearances that you would be concerned about? Now, Justice Ziegler has articulated, and I assume you adopt, the observation that it would be difficult, to put it gently, for a circuit court judge or any judge to rule on a matter directly concerning the integrity of one of their immediate family members.
Correct.
In addition to that, are there any other concerns that you have in regard to, as you use the phrase, appearance?
You know, I don't think there are significant concerns, actually. I mean, in a case like TOTI, the problem arises when a judge refuses to dismiss, where one party has expressed a problem and the judge declines.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, the appearance is that you didn't get a fair trial because the judge's relative is on the jury. And the judge's relative is going to read signals from the judge, or someone will think that, and do what the judge wants, even if the judge doesn't. That was what was said in Toti. And Toti made the same arguments that on both the lead opinion and the concurrence that Justice Ziegler made about recusal and about the appearance of impropriety. But what you are saying is you're requiring a motion.
I think that's an acceptable alternative to require. Yeah.
But you're saying, hey, you don't move, it's on the record, it's open, you don't move, it is gone.
Because there might be cases in which the defendant knows enough about the judge's relative to think, this person would be a good juror.
Well, it's not only the defendant, the state. Has
well, then the state, of course.
Why would the state want that juror? You seem to indicate the state won't.
Probably the opposite reason the defense would want it.
But, you know.
And there's an
the case that the state could ask.
That's right, because there's this appearance on both sides.
Potentially.
Yeah. Okay. So you. State's position, if I understand your argument, is, one, there's forfeiture. You didn't make the motion, you're out. If you make the motion, then what's the state's position about how the judge should rule?
The state's position is that within a narrowly defined class of immediate family members.
All right. Then if it's within a narrowly defined class, the judge must?
Yes.
Judge must, which is somewhat similar to what the Court of Appeals said, except as to the forfeiture issue.
I wouldn't describe it as forfeiture, but.
Well, because there, okay. So, did the Court of Appeals have authority to say, one, forfeit here? Had it not been forfeited, then we would have said, sua sponte must remove the immediate family member.
I don't think the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals would have had the power if it perhaps had the power, if it concluded that these such a juror were objectively biased.
But here's what your brief says on that issue. The Court is on top of 17. The Court of Appeals said, and it's quoting paragraph 22. We understand that the current, this is interpreting the concurrence, to have concluded within the inherent power of the Supreme Court, this rule that you that the trial court must get rid of this juror, is necessary to promote the efficient and effective operation of the state's court system, with a quote. That quote does not come, I don't think, from the Court of the Toti concurrence. It comes from Jennings. In other words, pardon me?
You're right.
I did not find anywhere in the Toti concurrence reference to the Supreme Court's supervisory, administrative, inherent power. The concurrence talked about the trial court's inherent power. Do you agree?
I agree. But then the question is, if an appellate court is going to direct a trial court to exercise its power in a certain manner,
right,
which court has the authority to
I suggest that maybe you think only the Supreme Court can?
Yes.
Okay. In the next case we have, the question is, what's the inherent power of a trial court to modify probation. And there'll be prior cases that talk about what's the inherent power of a trial court to modify sentencing. Mm-hmm. And there'd be a whole series of them. And an interpretation of inherent power, I don't think, is limited to the Supreme Court. You think it is?
No, I think trial courts certainly have inherent powers.
Okay, and they have to be defined and then applied, right?
I do not think the Court of Appeals has the power to set a rule for trial courts to follow in all cases.
Well, to take away the rule, because, you know, then you're answering the question. Does the Court of Appeals have the power to interpret the inherent power of a trial court?
Sure. And okay. I think the Court of Appeals certainly can say it's within the inherent power of a trial court.
Okay.
So speaking of rules, counsel, what is the rule, if you were going to have the opportunity to write this opinion or ask us directly, what is the rule that you would like to have emerge from this case?
Well, frankly, the issue that we've been talking about up to now...
It's not your key issue.
...is not the issue that...
I'm very well aware, and that might have been in response to a series of questions, too.
Yeah.
But why don't you articulate what rule you're asking for?
Well, two rules. One is that because this is an issue that has arisen and might arise in the future, that this court should carefully and narrowly define what immediate family members raise such concerns.
And I think in your brief you suggested to the second degree by marriage,
right,
including by marriage.
Right.
Okay.
The other...
And what's your bottom line on that? Then the trial judge must...
If there is...
Strike
a,
them? Okay.
If this court doesn't adopt a rule requiring sua sponte, striking by the removal by the judge, then that court must, trial court must grant a motion.
Subject to a harmless error test?
I wouldn't describe it as harmless error. I would say if the defendant does not move to strike the juror for cause, I don't think he or she should be able to complain later that the family...
Then I misapprehended your response to the Chief Justice. So no duty to sua sponte, but a duty to grant if the motion is made.
But if no motion is made,
yes,
I don't think a defendant can come back later. And this was the rule under, even under the Ramos regime, where there was a Court of Appeals decision in 2000, Williams, in which...
Just so I'm clear, so your answer is yes. No duty to sua sponte, but if a motion is made, a duty to grant.
Correct.
Okay.
What's the other rule that you want?
That if the defendant does not move to strike for cause, but exercises a peremptory challenge, the defendant is not entitled to a new trial under the Lindell holding and rationale, because any error up to that point is cured by the defendant's exercise of a peremptory strike.
Here's another alternative. The defendant moves to strike. The judge errs by saying, no, I will not do that. The defendant doesn't exercise the peremptory challenge. What's that happens? That's Toti, isn't it?
Well, that's Toti, and that's following, that goes, rule goes back to at least Gesch and Lindell, where the court has declined to hold that a defendant forfeits the challenge by failing to make a peremptory under those circumstances. The state might take issue with that, but this isn't the
That's
case
the
to
rule.
Review it,
okay.
to review that. But the law in this state, at least since Gesch, is that if the defendant makes a motion to strike a juror who should have been removed for cause, the trial court denies the motion, the defendant's failure to exercise a peremptory does not result in a forfeiture.
Counsel, can you highlight for me exactly what happened? There's a reference to the exchange with the judge about something like Judge Stengel said, hey, if you want her off, before we even start jury selection, I'll take her off the panel, and then we can proceed, and no one asked for that. Is that on the record? Was that something he later references that he says he said, but it's not in the record? I mean, was that actually, was the court reporter typing that as he had that exchange with the lawyers?
No, that was an off-the-record discussion prior to jury selection. This was what the trial judge recollected at the post-conviction hearing. Defense counsel just could not remember. Defense counsel didn't deny that conversation occurred, but the trial judge was pretty emphatic that he had, in fact, had that conversation.
What about that, having an on-the-record exchange, a waiver, if you will, or a motion or a discussion about what can be done with respect to a juror, instead of automatically labeling them biased one way or the other and setting forth a group of people that are deemed to be automatically biased? What do you think of that? Do you think it'd be okay if a judge said, look, I know these, I used to do that all the time. These people are familiar to me. They're on the, if you're in a small town, I know lots of people, and they think they know you, or they do know you. And so, you know, sometimes even members of the jury say, judge, you know, I want to bring up that I know you from wherever. And you may not even feel like you know them very well, but they want to bring it up. Happens all the time. What do you do? What's the best practice for a judge, in your view?
In the situation not involving a family member?
Leave it to this case, because hypotheticals don't prove to be very useful.
I'm sorry, what's your hypothetical? I couldn't
hear. I don't have a hypothetical. I have real facts. This case, what should he have done before jury selection, on the record?
It would have been preferable had the judge put it on the record before jury selection that he, in fact, had this conversation with the attorneys and offered to remove his daughter-in-law at their request.
Or have the conversation on the record with the defendant present.
Right.
And have the defendant say, you know, I'm not making a motion, or I've talked to my lawyer about
it. Again, would that have been the preferable approach? Sure. I don't think there's any basis in the record, though, for challenging the trial court's, what it amounts to, a finding that that conversation did, in fact, occur.
Well, why? What would the result be? This is my mother-in-law is on it, or daughter-in-law is on it, on the jury panel. I'm telling you that. I think she... I haven't talked to her about the case. Exactly what he said. Is he looking for a waiver? Is he looking for the state to say it's okay with me that she sits or that she be on the jury and then we'll all use our peremptories and then get a waiver from both parties of what you think is the correct law that immediate family members must be stricken? I mean, is that the point of this?
I can't read any intent one way or the other.
Oh, I know that. But I'm asking you, why would you, the judge, do that and put it, other than say it's my daughter-in-law? Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of the trial judge discussing the juror with the potential juror with counsel? Can either party waive it and say it's okay with me, judge?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So if the judge wants a waiver or thinks this, there might be a waiver or is giving them the opportunity, then you put it on the record and say, in effect, I'm telling you this because under the law, if we do what the state wants, I'm obliged to strike her. if you want her as a possibility, you got her, right?
Right. And I think then that completely eliminates the concern the Court of Appeals expressed and which Ms. Sellhausen has expressed about defense counsel being worried about alienating or antagonizing the judge. I mean, and that's why I don't think that was an issue here.
It's kind of interesting because I just hear that very differently. I hear that that most of the defense attorneys or attorneys that would appear in my court and circuit court would probably want to offend me. That's the very concern raised by the Court of Appeals. And their concern about not wanting to, being reticent to take on the judge is a real concern for some lawyers, others not. But the Court of Appeals discussed that quite a bit in their opinion, but you seem to give it virtually no credence.
My red light is on.
I know, but you should respond to it. This is the Lundell distinction. That's how the Court of Appeals distinguished Lundell.
Right.
Okay, what do you think?
Well, I guess the question is, one, in this case, is there any indication whatsoever that there was any hesitation? And the answer is no. There was a post-conviction hearing. The trial counsel testified. There was nothing in the testimony that suggested any hesitation or any concern about antagonizing the judge. In fact, when post-conviction counsel suggested that was a concern, the circuit court said, don't put words in counsel's mouth. That's not what he said. So on the facts of this case, I think there's just no basis for that. Trial counsel is expected to advocate vigorously for his or her client. Trial counsel often risks antagonizing a trial judge for many reasons.
Maybe it's just a different perspective of human nature. Yeah. Appellate counsel is supposed to aggressively advocate for their client. But my guess is that you are very conscious of not wanting to tick off one of us.
I try my best.
Well, you got me today.
Apologize.
I'm teasing you, counsel. That ends your 25-plus minutes, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Byron C. Lichtstein, Attorney Lichtstein, Frank J. Remington Center, UW Law School, representing the defendant, Sharon Sellhausen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I am Byron C. Lichtstein, representing Sharon Sellhausen.
Mr. Lichtstein, I wanted to ask Mr. Castle something, but I don't want to keep him standing up there, so I want to give him the time to think about it. And if you need time to think about it, fine, too. But we were talking about this waiver idea, right? Can somebody waive this kind of a challenge? If a judge is looking at the Code of Judicial Conduct, 6004, sub 4E, and then sub 6, which says you can take a waiver of recusal, you're looking at whether the judge or the judge's spouse or a person within the third degree of kinship to either of them, which I've heard the chief previously say is impossible to define. You're looking at whether any of those people might be a material witness in a proceeding or a lawyer or there are other areas. But if you're talking about that person actually being a witness in a case where the judge is called upon to decide their credibility, perhaps, and make determination, you can take a waiver from the parties under this rule, it seems. So what do you think of that in light of what Mr. Castle said should be an almost automatic exclusion and where you sit here? I mean, if the judge, not just a jury, but the judge could actually sit and decide a case and a trial and a motion with a family member as a material witness if the parties waive recusal. Why should it be a different standard here with a jury?
Several answers to that, Your Honor. I think the first answer is that a potential juror, to me, is a different situation than a witness. I think what happened here required the judge to make a ruling about whether a potential juror could be a fair and impartial juror. That's a quite direct analysis about the merits of the juror. And I think that's typically going to be a lot more than you're going to get with a material witness. My second answer on that would be that I think you brought up the concern, which I think is quite valid, that in many communities, the judge is going to know a lot of people. And there are going to be a lot of those people that come for jury selection. And I think that for most of those, an automatic exclusion isn't required. I think what we want to do is carve out a narrow class of people. And in that class, the concerns are so significant because the relationship is typically so close. That's why I think the second degree of kinship is a good place to draw the line, because you're dealing with a class of relationships that is so often that close that it will raise the kind of concerns that we're worried about. Outside of that class, I think it makes sense for the parties in the court to inquire on a case-by-case basis into that relationship. I think that does pose some of the same problems that we've been discussing, but I think you have to draw the line somewhere, and I think drawing the line at those very close relationships makes sense.
You know, but Thanksgiving's coming up, and all around this country we're going to have a lot of Thanksgiving tables where people are related to each other but hardly see eye to eye on issues. You know, just because someone's related doesn't mean they're automatically going to do something to try to please a judge or someone else. People have very different points of view, as that might
That's true, Your Honor, and no categorical rule is ever going to be perfect. If you have a rule, you are going to exclude some people who wouldn't pose the problems. But I think in the vast majority of cases, people within the second degree of kinship pose significant problems of being able to understand the judge's predispositions, read the judge's body language, be able to be more likely to discern a point of view and defer to that. I think within that narrow class of people, it makes sense to have a categorical rule.
Well, why do we have to make a rule at all? In Toti, no rule was made. All that the court said, whichever opinion you read, is this person is out. Why can't the court say we decide this case? This case, a daughter-in-law is in or out. You would say out. Why do we have to define the category yet? Why can't we work on the category incrementally by case law?
You don't, Your Honor, and in fact that was my...
Don't have to decide that. Don't decide the category, okay.
Correct, and in fact, that was my first reaction when the state's petition for review was filed in this case, is that we don't need to go outside the fact situation here. This case has been decided. We have a case that involves a daughter-in-law. You don't need to go beyond the narrow facts here and decide fact situations that aren't presented. You're much more aware than I of the problems of doing that, ruling on fact situations that aren't before you. Appellate courts typically avoid doing that, and that was my first reaction. The state now, though, has proposed a rule, and I'm simply expressing my agreement that if there is a rule, I think the state's definition of that rule is a good way to define it. I think there actually is quite a bit of agreement here between the state and Ms. Sellhausen. We agree that by far the best practice here would have been for the circuit court to strike his daughter-in-law sua sponte. And we agree on the reason, I believe, if I heard Mr. Castle correct, that we don't want to put lawyers in the position of having to tell a circuit court judge that his or her daughter-in-law should be struck from the jury.
And that's part of what I was getting at before. You tell judges, I'm going to ask you to recuse yourself or I'm going to waive that. I mean, should we throw out 6004 and the waiver of recusal? Because, I mean, there you're not just telling a judge, your daughter-in-law is someone that I don't want to see. You're saying you, judge, can't be fair. You, judge, need to get off the case. I mean, under your theory, you can never really accept a true waiver, yet it happens.
Well, I think you have here you don't need to deal with recusal at all, and I hope I'm getting the import.
It's the waiver issue. If you're concerned about telling a judge, boy, I don't want your daughter-in-law sitting on a jury, shouldn't you also be concerned about the situation where you're telling a judge, I don't want you sitting on a case? But people do that all the time. Or conversely, they say, judge, it's fine if you stay on the case. I waive the right to have you get off. I mean, that's a bigger concern than a daughter-in-law.
Well, I think that the concern that's presented in this case, and I hope I'm coming at your question directly, the concern that's presented in this case is that it is a very difficult predicament for a judge to say to a lawyer, counselor, my daughter-in-law is in the jury pool. You think she can be a fair juror?
But yet a judge can say, counselor, my daughter's a witness. Do you want me off the case? Do you want a new judge? Or do you want me to sit on the case? That's exactly how that can work out.
I guess in that situation, I think it would depend on what the facts involving the witness are. I would want to know more about what kind of witness we're dealing with, whether there are rulings that the judge is going to have to make about perhaps the scope of the witness's testimony or the witness's credibility. And I can't claim to be as familiar with the rule that you're...
I don't want to take you down this path any further. That's fine.
Counsel, it seems to me that the argument advanced by Ms. Sellhausen rests to a certain extent on the assumption that either questioning of one of the judge's relatives, immediate family members, or a motion to strike for cause is going to so offend the trial court judge that it will taint the proceedings or bias the proceedings against someone in Ms. Sellhausen's position. Is that perception accurate?
I think the general idea is accurate, although I wouldn't put it quite as strongly as you did. I don't think I'm assuming that such a motion is always going to offend the trial
right.
court. But
and I think you've fairly said that. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Second part of my question, Justice Prosser, if I may, the second part of my question, when I was reading the briefs preparing for this and thinking about this, one of the thoughts that came to mind is, you know, several of us on the bench have been trial court judges, and all of us know a lot of trial court judges in this state. And I wonder if we aren't being asked by Ms. Sellhausen to create a rule, a blanket rule, sort of based or premised upon an assumption that trial court judges in this state are so sensitive that they're going to be offended by such a request. And I'm a little hesitant, I'm a little leery about just sort of going with any assumption when it comes to, in effect, creating a rule. This is more of like a rule-making process, which Ms. Sellhausen is asking us to engage in effect.
I don't think the message you're sending is that you're telling circuit court judges they're sensitive. I think you're sending two other critical messages. One is to lawyers. You're telling them that they don't have to be in the position of telling a sitting judge that his or her immediate family member can't be a fair juror. I think that's just an extraordinarily difficult situation for a lawyer to be in. I think both of the opinions in Toady spoke to that. And you're adding a safeguard to keep lawyers out of that situation. But the second message...
Okay, we'll... All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yes.
The second message has to do with what you're telling the public about the integrity of circuit courts. A clear rule that tells circuit court judges, don't mess around with this. When this occurs, circuit courts ought to act swiftly to deal with the problem and make it clear to everyone who's looking on that they are above any question, above any doubts about their propriety. That is a better rule. You do not want a rule that injects doubt into the issue of whether circuit courts are above that level of propriety. And I think a clear sua sponte rule accomplishes that.
Two things. The first is that I think the concurrence in Toti rested, as I read it, on the premise that when it comes to foreseeable problems, such as an issue of juror misconduct or an allegation of juror misconduct, that it certainly would be better if the judge was not going to be called upon to possibly rule upon the conduct of an immediate family member. So I read the concurrence anyway as resting more on court administration, whether it's couched in terms of the inherent authority of the trial court or any other way. It seemed to me more a matter of court administration, saying, look, you can see these problems coming down the road. Why not head it off at the pass? It's a little different, though, from making a blanket rule that sort of rests. Even in your response to me, your responses did rest on the presumption that there is going to be this taint of bias if a judge's immediate family member serves on the jury. And I wonder, just as a course of, as a general principle, as well as one that directly affects the issues we're talking about, couldn't we equally presume that the judges of this state are going to be very mindful of their duty to see that there's an impartial jury impaneled, regardless of whether it's their daughter-in-law or anybody else? And if any of the lawyers, if any of the attorneys will ask questions that will indicate that a potential juror, no matter who they are, if they're going to somehow interfere with having an impartial juror preside over that trial, then they need to be excused. Why shouldn't we leave that to the sound discretion of the trial courts, reviewable as an abuse of discretion standard?
Well, I mean, I think I'll answer that just by referring back to my original answer to the Chief Justice. My first reaction to the state's petition for review is you don't need a broad rule for all cases. You can decide this case in front of you. And the result of this case in front of you ought to be, in my opinion, the trial judge ought to have struck his daughter-in-law sua sponte. And I think you can do the very same thing here. That would be the narrowest ground.
And this will be my last question. That sort of skips over, and I noticed it in your response to the Chief Justice, too, that sort of skips over the fact that the Court of Appeals rested their decision on court administration, on the concurrence in Toti.
Well, I think that's true, but I think the holding that I'm proposing, that narrow holding, can be rooted in principles of court administration. I guess I don't see the inconsistency there.
No, that's not where. Well, anyway, okay. Thank you,
Justice Prosser.
Could we do a little role playing here? Counsel, my Aunt Jessica is a member of the jury panel, and I will certainly be happy to excuse her if any member, any attorney requests so.
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate your very magnanimous offer to excuse your aunt, but I don't believe I can take that at face value. No, Your Honor, I'm sure that if I was in that position, I wouldn't feel comfortable telling you. Your Honor, quite frankly, I don't think your aunt should preside. I have questions about her ability to be fair and impartial. If I was in that position, I would feel awkward saying that to you. And that's not because of any doubts I have about your judgment or impartiality or about your aunt. It's just that it's a difficult position to be in when an authority figure, the judge, commenting on their own family member, asks you to make a judgment about whether that family member can be fair or impartial.
I don't think the question required counsel or you in the hypothetical to comment on the partiality or lack thereof or
of the aunt. It was just an offer saying, my aunt's on the panel. If anybody wants me to remove her, I will. It would be just as easy for counsel to say, it's a very gracious offer. Thank you, Your Honor. I will take you up on it. Period. There's no need to talk about the qualities of the aunt, is there?
I think a request to excuse the aunt implicitly, and in my view,
but you didn't get a request. The judge offered you.
It was an offer. Right.
Well, I think accepting the offer implicitly says, I, the lawyer, have doubts about whether your aunt's a suitable juror.
Counsel, I'm reading from the state's brief. Maybe I'm misreading it, but I understand an aunt, uncle, nephews, nieces are third degree. Third degree of kinship. Is that correct?
That's true, Your Honor.
Now, counsel, let's do this again. Counsel, I noticed that my next-door neighbor, Fred, who's a member of my church, and we are members of Kiwanis together, is a member of the jury panel. I'll be happy to excuse Fred from the panel if either attorney requests that.
I think my answer to that is that under the rule that the state has proposed, which I agree with, for that juror, that wouldn't fall within any kind of exclusion. I think that would be something that's handled in the normal course of voir dire. I, as the lawyer, then would be in the position of having to question the potential juror about the relationship. And quite frankly, I think there's some awkwardness to that process, but I acknowledge, mainly for the reason that Justice Ziegler pointed out, that that's going to happen quite frequently, and I don't think you want an automatic exclusion for every next-door neighbor and friend or business associate. So in that scenario, I don't think that's handled any differently than any other issue that comes up during voir dire with a juror. Are
you going to take his offer or not?
It probably
the judge made an offer to you. Are you going to take it or not?
Well, I think that's going to depend on local circumstances. Do I know the judge? Do I know the neighbor? What do I know about whether they'd be a favorable juror?
Okay, so you want to go through voir dire before you take the offer. Is that your response?
Well, I would think that if I've practiced in that community and know that judge, I'm going to have an idea of whether I want someone closely connected to the judge. But in the abstract, yes, I think the option for voir dire is where this should go.
I should have said voir dire or other personal knowledge because lawyers do check up on jurors, right?
But so I guess the answer to your question is yes. I'm going to make an individualized assessment based on what I know about the juror and anything that I learned during voir dire.
Mr. Lichtenstein, let me ask you this. The Court of Appeals justified ignoring the holding in Lindell. On the basis that, at least as I read it, of speculation. Is there anything in the record that actually supports the position taken by the Court of Appeals to distinguish and therefore not to apply Lindell here?
Well, I think there are very good reasons not to apply Lindell here.
Are those reasons in the record in any way or supported by the record in this particular case?
I think they are in a way, Your Honor, and I will answer that very directly. But I think there are several reasons why Lindell should not apply, and I think some of them are supported by the record. So let me elaborate. The first reason, I think, is that unlike in Lindell, where the peremptory challenge cures what was just a single trial court error in denying a motion to strike, what you have here is a much more structurally unfair situation. The lack of a sua sponte strike here sets in motion a cascading series of events that rendered all of the jury selection process with respect to this potential juror unfair. And potentially imperiled the fairness of the trial. The cascading series of events that I'm referring to started with the judge apparently having some kind of ex parte conversation the night before or interaction where he learned that his daughter-in-law was going to be on the jury pool. Then the next day, he has an off-the-record conversation with the lawyers. Two problems, in my opinion, right off the bat. Next, he leads his daughter-in-law during voir dire through a set of leading questions that, in my opinion and the opinion of the Court of Appeals, were merely designed to cement the idea that leaving her in the pool was fine. And then finally, he allows the, or puts the attorney in a position where the attorney has to voir dire the judge's daughter-in-law with the judge looking on. And any questions that the attorney had about the daughter-in-law's fairness, he would have had to explore right there with the judge looking on. And then the last problem with this is that he forces the defense attorney to exercise a peremptory challenge on the judge's daughter-in-law. And I think a defense attorney in that position could quite easily fear that that might have consequences. Whether conscious or unconscious, the judge might not be happy about that. Having not excused the daughter-in-law sua sponte originally, the lawyer then having to exercise a peremptory challenge, I think might fear that. Now, I think the state has argued, and I think your question gets to this point, that, well, there's no evidence in the record, there's no specific rulings or comments by the defense attorney that show the defense attorney was intimidated or was somehow cowed by what had happened during jury selection. But I think it's quite unrealistic to be surprised by that. A lawyer who is in that position and who is concerned that exercising a peremptory challenge has caused some kind of negative reaction in the judge, how is that lawyer going to behave during trial? Well, they're going to do everything they can not to further offend the judge, meaning we can't expect that lawyer to then, during the trial, bring the matter up again or note on the record, "Judge, I'm hesitant to make my challenge as vigorous as I could because I'm concerned about what happened during jury selection." I think we can't realistically be surprised about the lack of specific comments by the lawyer on that point.
Counselor, do you have empirical data that shows that trial judges are this thin-skinned and this vindictive when motions are made before them that they may not like? I mean, I'm surprised at the tack you're taking, frankly.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have the view that trial judges are thin-skinned.
That's what your argument is based on, that the lawyer can't make this motion because the judge is so thin-skinned that he's going to hold it against him throughout the trial. I mean, that's what I'm hearing you say.
Okay.
And that's
well,
what I got from your brief as well, frankly.
Well, I don't mean to be directly saying that I think trial judges are very thin-skinned. What I am saying is that I think it's human nature. When people are confronted with a statement, whether implicit or explicit, that their wife or daughter or mother isn't an appropriate juror, I think that that can, consciously or unconsciously, arouse a negative reaction. I think that's human nature. And I can say that the post-conviction hearing, to me, was evidence of that. Mr. Castle has pointed to my comment at the post-conviction hearing as evidence that, in fact, well, there was no problem. None of the issues came to fruition. But I can tell you I was there, and I felt the judge's I wouldn't call it that he was being thin-skinned, but he was quite irritated with me for making this argument. And that's why I backed off in the moment where he said to me, "Don't put words in counsel's mouth." It was palpable. There was some definite heat in the courtroom that day, and that to me was just further confirmation of what I've been saying, that this is an uncomfortable, difficult situation. I guess I would respectfully say that I don't think it means anyone's thin-skinned if they have that reaction. It's human nature, in my opinion, to feel strongly about family relationships, and when a family member is criticized.
My recollection, counsel, from my review of the transcript, or that part of the briefs containing the transcript, was the point where the judge said that was where you were indicating that defense counsel felt chilled, I think was the word, or inhibited from inquiring, and That's where the judge, I mean, could that frustration, I wonder, have arisen from the fact that the judge already said that he had given the attorneys the opportunity, and I think he used the phrase, be happy to take her off the jury, and also coupled with the idea that I didn't see, and I looked very hard in this record, counsel, to see some kind of indication that defense counsel did in fact feel hindered or constrained somehow. That was not my impression. Is it equally possible that the judge's frustration stemmed from the idea that in his mind, in his view, he had done everything possible to accommodate everybody's desire to see an impartial jury impaneled?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. I think as to the judge's off-the-record statement that he would be happy, I think that he would be happy to excuse the juror. I think the judge may remember it that way, but it may not have occurred exactly in that way, and it may have been heard quite differently by the lawyer for reasons that we've already talked about, that I'm not sure the offer would have been received in quite the same way the judge thought it was. And I think that impression, to me, is confirmed by what happened during voir dire. The judge's questioning of the juror during voir dire didn't sound like someone who would be happy to excuse the juror. It sounded like someone who was convinced there wasn't a problem and was using voir dire to make a record confirming that there wasn't a problem. So I guess I don't share the view that that off-the-record conversation proves that the judge had dispelled
I'll tell you what, counsel, that's why I deliberately asked my question, not whether you thought it was. Neither of us was there, right? You were not there, right?
Right.
Okay. Neither was I. I'm just saying, is it equally possible that was? I mean, I've read the transcript, too. I saw he got right to the bottom line about the impartiality, but then he opened it up for questions from the counsel, from the attorneys. And I'm just throwing it out there. It does seem to me as if a large part of the argument does rest on some suppositions.
Well, I mean, I guess my response to that is that I think in some situations the potential for problems is so serious and clear that you don't have to inquire into whether the specific problems came to fruition. And I think this is a situation where it is not surprising that there isn't specific record evidence that the problems came to fruition.
Okay, you just used the phrase, the potential problems. The potential problems being?
Well, I think there are a lot of potential problems, but one of them is that the very difficult position that the lawyer is put in having to challenge the potential juror in front of the judge, the possibility that the judge would consciously or unconsciously have a negative reaction to that. There's a harm to, I think, a serious harm to the appearance of probity and partiality and independence of the court to people who watch that. I note that my light is on, Your Honor.
Sure, but you're allowed to finish your thought.
Questioning.
Do you see, though, how those first two reasons sort of assume the absolute worst about the trial court judges?
I guess I don't see them as assuming the worst. I see them as acknowledging the human nature that I've alluded to in response to Justice Rogensack and the likelihood that there are problems and that this is a situation that we just don't want to put lawyers and judges in. So I wouldn't say that I'm assuming the worst is always going to happen. I'm saying there is a quite serious danger that will come to fruition and that to avoid problems and to protect the appearance of propriety, we should have a clear rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Castle. I have a question for you right out of the bat. Let me ask it this way. Suppose the court adopts a rule so that it doesn't, it recognizes that the judges across the state, which I agree with, are good, know their job, and they have inherent powers to make the court system work as to any particular case.
And so, therefore, it is within each judge's discretion whether to strike a member of the family or anyone else, right? And therefore, that's reviewable under abuse of discretion, erroneous exercise of discretion standards. So, does that help us? Does Toti stand for the proposition that if you don't strike your, was it mother-in-law? If you don't strike,
mother.
They're the same to me. If you don't strike your mother, that is, remove her as a juror, that is an erroneous exercise of discretion.
Does Toti
stand for the proposition then, if you don't remove your mother, the judge doesn't remove, it is an erroneous exercise of discretion?
I don't think the lead.
No. The lead opinion says that's objective.
Right.
But the concurrence, it was an evenly divided court. You've heard about discretion here, right?
Right.
You know that there are three justices who, at least at that time, they can change their minds, and I can change my mind, right? The Court of Appeals liked the concurrence. So that concurrence can be interpreted as it is an exercise of discretion whether to strike a family member or neighbor or anybody else, right?
Yes, although I understood the concurrence in Toti to say in the case of a mother,
okay,
it is necessarily.
That's right. Okay, so it would be an erroneous, if you took a discretionary standard, saying judges are big people, they can handle it on their own, they don't need any interpretation by us about their inherent power. So, Toti stands for the proposition that keeping the mother on the jury was an erroneous exercise of discretion and will be reversed. That's what happened there. So can this state, if we adopt an erroneous exercise of discretion, then we would be reviewing whether a daughter-in-law here, is an erroneous exercise of discretion, right? And what
would
you
say? Well, we wouldn't be reviewing that in this case because there was not a motion to strike.
I understand that. Motion, but let's put it in motion to strike and no peremptory, just like Toti. Okay. What would you say? Erroneous exercise of discretion?
Yes. I think the relationship of a judge to a daughter-in-law is close enough to that.
So that would be, and by these discretion reviews, we would be building up a list of relationships.
Now, the reason the state, in its petition for review, said it's important for this court to define a category is because, as it stood, the Court of Appeals had established a rule that said immediate family members, but didn't say what those were.
So if the rule had said within the second degree or third degree or whatever it said, that would have satisfied the state? Except for Lindell,
yes.
The first part. Okay.
The state wouldn't have any quarrel. But that brings me to Justice Ziegler's question that you didn't get a chance to ask me, was why, if in the case of SCR 60.04, recusal is not automatically required because it can be waived in the case of a material witness who is related to the judge or even a lawyer who is related to the judge, why should not the same occur with a juror? And I think the answer is that it should be able to, and that would argue in favor of my alternative, which says you don't need to make it a rule to require the judge to sua sponte remove the juror. Leave it to the parties to decide whether to make a motion to strike.
Well, if you don't make a motion to strike, have they waived it?
Yes.
Or forfeited.
Forfeited.
Because you don't have a knowing intel. You don't show that. So
yeah, unless there were a colloquy
right.
On the record exactly. Explaining.
Or post-verdict, and you've got the, really, we don't want that, do we? A post-verdict hearing.
Let's get it
up front and early.
I don't think this is a case where a defendant needs to make a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver. I think this is something where forfeiture would apply. I see my light is on.
Any other questions? Thank you, Attorney Cassell and Attorney Lichtstein, for yet another case involving juror bias. We've had a fair share of them in a variety of circumstances, and this one will join Boucher and others. Thank you. We conclude our argument in 10 AP 445 CR State versus Sellhausen. The court will take a brief recess before it hears State versus Doughty. It will be just a couple of minutes.